Section 12, The Three Jewels and Other Writings. Between 1959 and 1964, when I returned to England, much of my time was devoted to literary work, and since it was during this same period that light on the topic of going for refuge came to me from Tibetan Buddhism, it was only natural that a portion of that light should be reflected in some of the books and articles I was then engaged in producing. The first of these, chronologically speaking, was an article on ordination and initiation in the three yanas, which appeared in the November 1959 issue of The Middle Way. As its title suggested, the purpose of the article was to clear up some of the confusion that, for many people, surrounded the whole subject of ordination and initiation, by explaining what the different ordinations and initiations actually were, and how they corresponded to the three yanas and to the particular spiritual ideals in which those yanas found expression. The three yanas were, of course, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana, representing the three successive phases of development through which Buddhism passed in India, as well as the three progressive stages of spiritual ascent in the life of the individual Buddhist. But though going for refuge was mentioned in the article only once, in connection with ordination in the Hinayana, ordination and initiation in the three yanas is far from being devoid of significance for the process whose history I am now tracing. Speaking of the difference between ordination or sangvara on the one hand and tantric initiation or abhisheka on the other, I pointed out that, according to the fully developed Indo-Tibetan tradition, the rite of admission to upasika, shramanera, bhikshu, or bodhisattva status is in each case termed a sangvara, literally restraint, control, obligation, or vow, end of quote. This was an important discovery. The fact that admission to upasika, shramanera, bhikshu, and bodhisattva status was in each case termed a sangvara, or ordination, meant that the differences between the various grades of religious persons was of far less significance than they were sometimes thought to be. In particular, it meant that the difference between the monk and the layman was not a difference between the ordained and the unordained. Both monks and laymen were ordained persons, and both monks and laymen were, therefore, full members of the Buddhist spiritual community. This came very close to saying that sangvara, or ordination, was a unifying rather than a dividing factor in Buddhism. And therefore, very close to saying, as I afterwards did say, that ordination and going for refuge were in fact synonymous, and that going for refuge was a unifying factor in Buddhism. Indeed, it was the unifying factor. Moreover, speaking of the three successive phases of Buddhist historical development, I pointed out that the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana were not to be thought of as lying end to end, like so many sections of railway track, but that the earlier phase not only passes over into the latter, but is taken up into and incorporated by it and lives on in it. End of quote. This means, in effect, that going for refuge was taken up into the bodhicitta, so that the way was now clear for my later realization that the bodhicitta was the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. In 1961, by way of contributing to the debate that followed the publication in Ceylon of the report of the Buddha Sasana Commission, I wrote an article to which I gave the controversial title, Wanted, a New Type of Bhikkhu. A year later, encouraged by the letters of appreciation I had received, I wrote a second article, to which I gave the hardly less controversial title, Wanted, a New Type of Upasika. Both articles took the form of a series of aphorisms, 54 in the case of the first article and 63 in the case of the second, and both were reproduced in virtually all the English language Buddhist journals. Since they were written mainly for a Southeast Asian Buddhist readership, the articles were reformist rather than revolutionary in tendency. As the concluding aphorism of the first article expressly stated, the new bhikkhu was the old one, adapted to modern conditions. Nevertheless, since both articles were concerned to stress the importance of moral and spiritual qualifications, they both attempted, in effect, to bridge the gap between the monks and the laity. In the case of Wanted, a New Type of Bhikkhu, the attempt took the form of a strong attack on monastic formalism, which I continue to see as the besetting sin of the whole Theravada branch of the order, of the monastic order. The new type of bhikkhu will never commit the mistake of thinking that the wearing of the yellow robe makes him a monk, declared the opening aphorism, and in many of the succeeding aphorisms, this principle was applied to specific areas of the monk's life. In the case of Wanted, a New Type of Upasika, the attempt to bridge the gap between monks and laity took the form of a strong insistence that the Upasika too was a Buddhist, and that it was incumbent on him to act accordingly. In the words of the first three aphorisms of the article, the new type of Upasika will never commit the mistake of thinking that it is really possible for anyone to be a born Buddhist. He will not recite the Trisarana and Panchasila mechanically on Upasatha days without making any effort to embody them in his daily life. He will not think that the practice of the Dharma is the duty of the bhikkhu, but not the Upasika. End of quote. Clearly, my new type of bhikkhu and new type of Upasika would have a lot in common. So much in common would they have, indeed, that one might be forgiven for thinking that together they heralded the emergence of the Dharmachari and Dharmacharini. For, as I was shortly to realize, what Buddhists above all had in common, and what therefore constituted the fundamental basis of unity among them, was the fact that they all went for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and that such going for refuge was of central importance in their lives. As far as I know, this realization found its first unambiguous expression in the preface to the Three Jewels, where I spoke of going for refuge as the central act of the Buddhist life, from which all other Buddhist acts derive their significance, and without reference to which Buddhism itself is unintelligible. End of quote. Since the preface is addressed from the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, London, it must have been written in either 1965 or 1966, probably the latter. The Three Jewels itself, which was not published until 1967, had been written during the second half of 1961, and together with The Eternal Legacy, constituted my major literary undertaking during the period covered by this section of my history. Like the latter work, it started life as a series of articles for the Oriya Encyclopedia, that, in the process of writing, considerably outgrew the purpose for which they had been commissioned. Though in it I did not speak of going for refuge in the terms which, 3 or 4 years later, I spoke of it in the preface, some of my remarks on the subject of spiritual community showed how close I was to realizing the absolute centrality of that unique act, both for the individual Buddhist and for Buddhism. Thus, having insisted that the true criterion of the relation between the Buddha and his followers was not physical, not spatio-temporal, but spiritual, and that we were nearest to him when we most perfectly followed his example, I went on, the Sangha is primarily the community of those who, by virtue of their immediate or remote approximation to enlightenment, stand in spiritual relation to the Buddha and dwell spiritually in his presence. It is the community of those who, through their relationship with him, are also all spiritually related to one another. End of quote. In other words, the Sangha is primarily the community of those who go for refuge, for it is going for refuge that enables us to achieve the stages of the path and approximate to enlightenment, and going for refuge that forms the ultimate basis of our relationship with the Buddha, and therefore the ultimate basis of our relationship with other members of the Sangha. Again, enlarging on the fact that in the broadest sense of the term the Sangha coincided with the entire Buddhist community, monastic and lay, male and female, I wrote, during the lifetime of the master, relations between the eremitical monks who had gone forth and the householders at whose doors they daily stood for alms and in whose outhouses and gardens they lodged during the rains, were close and cordial, and a spirit of camaraderie prevailed. The latter could, if necessary, bring to the notice of the master public complaints against the Parivrajikas, and suggest changes in their mode of living. Such equalitarianism was natural. Their common devotion to the Buddha, and the extent to which his attainments transcended theirs, tended to reduce all distinctions among his followers, including that between monks and laymen, to a position of comparative insignificance. His impatience with the formalistic element in religion, and his uncompromising insistence on the necessary of personal realization of nirvana, moreover ensured that they should be distinguished, if at all, according to their intrinsic merits, rather than their socio-ecclesiastical status. Even though a man be richly attired, if he develops tranquility, is quiet, subdued and restrained, leading a holy life, and abstaining from injury to all living beings, he is a brahmana, he is a samana, he is a bhikkhu. That the homeless wandering monk, totally free from all worldly concerns, had a far better chance of reaching the goal was admitted, even emphasized, but that a householder, if sufficiently resolved, might sometimes reach it too, and that in the last resort it was transcendental attainment that mattered, not the wearing of yellow robes, more than one such saying of the Buddha testifies. End of quote. Here, the fact that it is their common devotion to the Buddha that tends to reduce all distinctions among his followers, including that between monks and laymen, to a position of comparative insignificance, implies that it is their common devotion to the Buddha that constitutes the fundamental basis of unity among Buddhists. But devotion to the Buddha finds its fulfillment in going for refuge to the Buddha, as well as to the Dharma and the Sangha. In saying that their common devotion to the Buddha tended to reduce all distinctions among his followers to comparative insignificance, I was therefore in effect saying that it was their common going for refuge that constituted the fundamental basis of unity among them. Moreover, having referred to the schism that took place in the Buddhist community between 100 and 200 years after the Buddha's parinirvana, I pointed out that the Mahayana had evolved for all followers of the Buddha a common spiritual ideal, i.e. the Bodhisattva ideal, and worked out a common path, the path of the 6 or 10 paramitas, thus lessening the tensions between the monastic and lay wings of the Maha Sangha, which were now united through the pursuit of a common spiritual objective, i.e. supreme Buddhahood, by means of the same or similar spiritual methods. End of quote. A common Vinaya for all Bodhisattvas, whether monks or laymen, was also evolved. Thus I had seen that the Mahayana had already made the Bodhisattva ideal the unifying factor in Buddhism. And having seen this, I had only to realize that the Bodhicitta was the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, in order to see that it was, in reality, going for refuge that was the unifying factor, and therefore the central act of the Buddhist life. A bird's eye view of Indian Buddhism, as I called it at one stage, was a lengthy article produced on the eve of my departure from India in 1964. Editorials for the Mahabodhi Journal accepted, it was therefore the last of my writings to be produced during the period covered by the present section of this history. It had been commissioned by the syndics of the Oxford University Press for the second edition of The Legacy of India, but having heard nothing from them for a long time, and having assumed, wrongly as it turned out, that they had decided not to use the article, in 1980 I included it in the 5th edition of A Survey of Buddhism as the introduction to that work. Originally, very little of the light that had come to me from Tibetan Buddhism on the subject of going for refuge was reflected in its pages. Having dealt with the Arya Sangha and the Bhikshu Sangha, or order of monks, I wrote, "In a more general sense, the Sangha comprises the entire Buddhist community, sanctified and unsanctified, the professional religieux and the lay devotees, men and women. As such, it is sometimes known as the Mahasangha, or Great Assembly. Lay devotees, upasikas and upasikas, are those who go for refuge to the three jewels, worship the relics of the Buddha, observe the five precepts of ethical behaviour, and support the monks. End of quote. This did not go nearly far enough. In 1978, when revising the article for inclusion in the fifth edition of the survey, I therefore made the following addition to the passage. Although, as time went on, the life of the monks diverged more and more sharply from that of the laity, the fact that all alike went for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha remained a common, potentially uniting factor, a factor that, in the case of the Mahayana, was strengthened by the development of the Bodhisattva ideal, which was an ideal equally for the monk and the layman, the nun and the laywoman. End of quote. This had the effect of bringing the article of 1964 more into line with my current thinking. Mention of the preface to The Three Jewels and the inclusion of A Bird's Eye View of Indian Buddhism in the fifth edition of the survey has, however, taken us rather too far ahead. Before leaving India, I went through one more stage in the process by which the meaning, significance, and importance of going for refuge became clear to me.